Hello, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we have some really interesting guests on. In the first half, we have Judith Finlinson. She's the author of You Are What Your Grandparents Ate. And then in the second half, we have Dawn Demure, who's a phytotherapy expert on healing and herbalism. But first, here's Alan with the Health First News.
You made your resolution. This year was finally going to be the year you lost weight. But then your neighbor stopped by with a plate of cookies, and well, your resolve didn't even last a day. Maybe next year? But instead of looking at your resolutions as a sweeping year-long project, what if you concentrated on making healthy changes every Monday? That way, if you slip up and dive into that pile of cookies, another chance to get it right is just a few days away. It's called the Healthy Monday Reset, and the idea is to send you into the week with a fresh mindset. Ron Hernandez, the managing director of the Monday campaigns, says what we really want people to do is implement a mindset change. If you think about the New Year's resolution, you pick one day a year to start changes, and if you fall off the wagon, it's another year. But with Monday, you have 52 opportunities in a year. Grocery shoppers may notice something new on snacks and other packaged foods. It's an updated nutrition label that's meant to give consumers enough information to make healthier choices about what and how much they're eating. Foods with multiple servings in a single package, like a big bag of potato chips, will now have a two-column label that will list the nutritional information in a single serving, alongside the calories, fat, cholesterol, protein, sugar, and sodium in the entire package. Foods that have between one and two servings, like a 20-ounce bottle of soda or a 15-ounce can of soup, will carry a single label that treats the package as a single serving. A lot of the dope you read online about the benefits of marijuana is just hooey, but it can influence attitudes and actions, researchers say. Looking at tens of thousands of pot-related posts on Twitter, researchers saw a lot of bogus health claims that they fear may drown out solid science. Researcher John Patrick Allum said these misleading messages are pervasive online. They want the public to be aware of the difference between a demonstrated, scientifically backed piece of health information and claims that are simply made up. He is an assistant professor of preventive medicine at University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine. The findings were published in the December issue of the American Journal of Public Health. If you have atrial fibrillation, or AFib, potentially dangerous irregular heart rhythm, giving up alcohol could ease your symptoms. That's what happened when researchers asked people with AFib who normally have roughly two drinks a day to stop drinking. When they compared the teetotalers to a similar group of people with AFib who continued drinking, the investigators found that those who abstained from alcohol delayed their next AFib episode and reduced the overall time spent in AFib. Senior study author Dr. Peter Kistler added that additional benefits of abstaining from alcohol include weight loss and reduced blood pressure. The study was published January 2nd in the New England Journal of Medicine.
We have Judith Finlinson with us today. She's a best-selling author who has written books on a variety of subjects from personal well-being and women's history to food and nutrition. A former national newspaper columnist for the Globe and Mail, a magazine journalist, and a board member of various organizations focusing on legal, medical, and women's issues. She's also the author of over a dozen cookbooks. Judith lives in Toronto, and she's here with us today. So welcome, Judith.
My pleasure to be here, Kathy.
This is quite the book you've written. It's a little bit different. You Are What Your Grandparents Ate. So much research and so many stories that you've put together. What caused you to write this book?
Well, I've always had a serious interest in nutrition as medicine, food as medicine. And that a lot of that grew out of a period when I was writing cookbooks. But prior to writing cookbooks, I had been a journalist and had been involved in medical issues. So basically, I was introduced to the work of David Barker, an epidemiologist who got the ball rolling on a whole field of science known as the developmental origins of health and disease. And his studies were really showing that what happened to a fetus while it was developing during pregnancy, and that would include impacts, he was initially looking at impacts like poor nutrition, could really be linked with the development of chronic disease later in life. This was really groundbreaking information when he started to develop it, and nobody kind of believed him. He started doing his first study was published in 1986 in the British medical journal, The Lancet, and everybody thought he was crazy. By the year 2000, all of the major epidemiologists in the United States and in Europe were saying, he's not crazy. There really is something to this. When, by the time I really stumbled on his work, which was about 5 or 6 years ago, I realized that it was groundbreaking, but that nobody really knew about it. So I decided that I would write a book to try and make the fundamentals of this field of science, which is now known as the developmental origins of health and disease, to really get the message out for people in plain English.
Judith, you've really looked at the nature and the nurture and kind of intertwine them rather than picking one side or another.
Well, actually, that's what the science says. Nature, one of the most prestigious scientific journals in the world, really did an overview a couple of years ago on whether it was nature or whether it was nurture. That is, do your genes determine your health, what you're born with, or do you determine your health by what you do to change it? And they found that it was basically pretty much evenly divided, but slightly weighted in the direction of nurture, i.e., you can modify your genes, your genetic heritage, by lifestyle modifications like good nutrition. I want to give you a few examples of things that kind of got the ball rolling because they're very compelling in terms of images. And this science really started with epidemiologists, and they're scientists that look at disease patterns in large groups of people. There were a lot of relevant discoveries going on at the same time, but one epidemiologist, a fellow named Lars Bergen, who is Swedish, found that young boys did studies based on the little town that he grew up in, and he found that young boys who ate too much around the time of puberty were more likely to have grandsons that died young. He also found that women who lived through a period of famine when they were pregnant significantly increased the possibility that their granddaughters would die earlier than normal. So you see two streams of this heredity, grandsons through males and granddaughters through females. These and other examples got people very interested in how what happened at certain stages of reproduction influenced long-term health. And we really began to get some answers to this around the year 2000 when another science known as epigenetics began to have an influence. And this comes back to your original question about nature and nurture. So what you need to know is that nature, your genes, are fixed, but your genes operate or function in a very dynamic environment, and they actually express themselves in different ways, and so how they express themselves is not fixed, and that is where the element of nurture comes in. So gene expression is influenced by the environment, and a key influencer on how your genes express themselves is nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really shown. There was a groundbreaking study, mouse study, the Agouti mouse study, which was done in 1998, if I remember correctly. And they were able to show, they had taken groups of very sickly mice that were bred to be very beautiful but didn't live very long, and supplemented their diets with specific nutrients that influenced an epigenetic process known as methylation. And by introducing these nutrients into the diets of pregnant females, they not only improve the health of the pregnant females, they improve the health of their progeny and also the next generation, so the grandchildren. And that was without further supplementation. And in other words, they were able to show that by providing the right nutrients, they could change the expression of the genes that were making the mice very sickly and predisposing them to an early death.
That's fascinating. Were they using the nutrition? Was it, did it come in synthetic supplements or did it come in just whole foods? Do you know?
They gave it to them in supplements.
Okay.
But obviously the best way to get it would be in whole foods.
Mm-hmm.
So we have many studies now in humans that show that even if you do have faulty patterns of gene expression, that they can be very, very quickly modified by doing things like improving nutrition, or also exercise is another one. They've done a series of studies on exercise and shown how that improves gene expression. And also, one of the other factors that influences gene expression is exposure to toxins. So avoiding toxins is another thing that one should be very watchful of.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you've connected, I guess this is the main reason it is, you are what your grandparents ate, but also you actually have connection with your grandparents through the mother's eggs developed while she was a fetus in your grandmother's womb. Like, that's really powerful. That's mind-blowing.
Well, it is. And this is how this idea of gene expression comes through as a transgenerational epigenetic inheritance. And that's why the title of my book is You Are What Your Grandparents Ate. And the way that it works is that environmental impacts like poor nutrition leave marks on cells, and these marks are known as epigenetic modifications. And these modifications function like a kind of biological memory that is passed on through the generations via reproductive cells. So it's not only the mother's egg, it's also the father's sperm. And this is a whole new area that they are beginning to look at in depth. But to come back to the mother's eggs, a female baby is born with all of her eggs. So even when you think about that, what you realize is that those eggs were forming while her mother was pregnant, and therefore that her mother's experiences while pregnant affect the quality of her daughters, that is, the female fetus, of her eggs. So those eggs would be the eggs that create the baby, and they would come with the epigenetic memory of the mother's experience. So poor nutrition is really passed on through the generations, and we can see that in certain areas. You can see it in intergenerational areas like in China or India, where they've had generations of poor nutrition. In the U.S., there's an area known as the Stroke Belt in the southeastern United States, which is a cluster of states, where the rate of stroke is extremely high, and it's intrigued epidemiologists since the 1930s because they realize that the vulnerability to stroke seems firmly rooted in birth and early life. Because when they move, even away from that area, those people who were born there take their stroke risk, increased stroke risk, with them. And what they've been able to do is look at that and find that those areas were characterized by high rates of poverty and disruption as a result of the Civil War, so for generations, and that the long-term effects of poor nutrition were taking a toll on women's bodies that was having an intergenerational effect and was predisposing this large group of people to an increased risk of stroke.
This is fascinating, Judith. Just hold that thought. We're going to go to a quick break, and we're going to come back right away.